Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Norman Swan and you're listening to The Health Report. In this program, an opportunity to hear from someone who's probably one of the world's top two or three researchers on the health effects of exercise. His work has had enormous influence on the recommendations that nations like Australia make about minimum levels of physical activity that we all need. But more than that, he's exploded quite a few myths along the way, not the least of which are about obesity. Now, you'd think they know all there is to know about exercise, but as you'll hear, that's far from the case. Steve Blair is Professor of Exercise Science at the University of South Carolina, and one of his more recent studies was into whether the benefits of exercise do indeed relate to how much you do.
Over the last decade, we've had public health recommendations for physical activity that focus on 30 minutes of moderate intensity activity on at least 5 days of the week. And there's a mountain of evidence supporting that recommendation as being very beneficial to health. But there's actually been very little study done with different doses of exercise. So in the jargon of science, we conducted a dose response study, which meant that we recruited 464 sedentary, overweight or obese, but basically healthy postmenopausal women. And we randomly assigned them to a control group in which they agreed to continue their present habits or to three different doses of exercise. The middle of these doses was the consensus 30 minutes a day, at least 5 days a week, or about 150 minutes of the equivalent of walking. One dose was one half of that, and the highest dose was one and a half times, or about 225 minutes a week.
So it was varied on time rather than intensity.
The intensity was clamped at 50% of their maximal capacity.
So you showed them the walking pace you wanted them to do.
All the exercise was under observation in the laboratory.
Oh, I see. So it wasn't pounding the streets. It was
No, you were really controlled. Yes, I think this is probably the largest single-center, tightly controlled exercise study that's ever been done.
And essentially you wanted to see whether or not there were any benefits less than that and whether there were greater benefits more than that.
Exactly. So as to address the question, well, suppose I only do half the recommendation, do I get any benefit? And if I do more than the recommendation, do I get more benefit or do I get proportionally more benefit?
And why choose postmenopausal women?
Well, in the U.S., it's easier to get funded if you're going to do a single-gender study if you do women instead of men. And, I mean, that's a smart-aleck answer. And the truth is there has been less research of this type done in women as compared with men. And we do know that they're the most sedentary segment of society and that millions and millions of them do essentially no exercise. So we thought it was a useful public health target.
How long did the study go? So how many weeks, months, years?
6 months of controlled exercise with, as I said, the exercise in the lab where the women came 3, 4, or maybe even 5 days a week. And we allowed them to alternate either walking on a treadmill or riding a recumbent cycle. So to give a little variety to it, we weren't zealots about, well, today you're on the treadmill, tomorrow you have to be on the cycle. But generally they alternated back and forth.
Just before we go on, I've often wondered about these recumbent cycles. What have they got going for them compared to just sitting up in the seat and on a normal cycle in the gym?
Well, they're more comfortable.
Oh, that's it, purely and simply.
You don't get saddle sores, so to speak. Right. Yeah, it's just more comfortable to sit there, and especially probably for large people. And then remember, these were overweight or obese women. At baseline, the body mass index average is about 32. You know, the work is what counts. How many watts are you cranking in?
Okay, what did you measure and what did you find?
The primary outcome measures were maximal oxygen uptake or aerobic fitness and resting systolic blood pressure.
That's the top
figure. I think I failed to mention that we recruited women who were kind of in the pre-hypertensive stage, and we wanted to get women with somewhat elevated pressure, but not pressure so high that they should go immediately to drugs. So the average resting systolic was about 139, as I recall.
And what did you find?
There was a very nice stair-step relationship across these three doses of exercise as compared with controls, highly statistically significant. The women who were 75 minutes a week actually improved on their fitness, their aerobic power, their maximal oxygen uptake, about 5% compared with the women in the control group. The women in the control group actually lost a little fitness over the 6 months, and again, the women in all three exercise groups improved. We actually didn't see much change in systolic blood pressure, a little bit to my surprise, but over the course of conducting this study, there had been some other work come out which suggests that, well, maybe exercise isn't as beneficial in lowering blood pressure as we once thought. But we did see major changes in fitness, which, of course, is a very important health characteristic, strongly related to the risk of chronic disease and early mortality. And the 75 minutes a week group made significant improvement. And one other thing, Norman, let me say about the exercise program, and believe me, I'm not bragging on myself. I'm bragging on my young colleague, Dr. Church, and his staff. I mean, this study ran just beautifully. And over 6 months, we could calculate for each woman how many calories she should burn, depending on which group she was in and depending on her body size. So we had a six-month caloric expenditure target. The average adherence was 97%. And I defy anyone to do better than that. So these women did exactly what we wanted them to do. Their exercise was just precisely on target. We ask all of them to wear step counters throughout the six-month period and report weekly their steps per day. And those didn't change over the course of the study. No difference between groups.
So coming into the lab didn't make them more active at the other times of the day. They went back onto the couch, did they?
Or more sedentary. I mean, that actually was the concern. There are people in exercise science who have said that if you put people in an exercise study, even if they come into the lab and they exercise, then they go home and sit more. Now, that was not the case with these women. There are other routine daily activities stayed pretty constant at about 4,500, 5,000 steps a day. And again, it was the same for all four groups.
And when you stepped up the length of exercise, you still got no effect on blood pressure?
All three exercise groups lowered their blood pressure a little bit, and in fact lowered it a little more than those in the control group,
but
the differences just weren't statistically significant.
Did you measure their cholesterol?
Yes, we measured a wide variety of biochemical measures, and we have a raft of data from this study. We saw a little change in the lipid profile.
And blood sugars, given that diabetes is a risk in this group?
Not much change there either. Actually, we were a little surprised because we recruited women, as I said, who were sedentary, overweight or obese, mildly hypertensive. We actually expected them to have a pretty unhealthy risk profile at baseline, but they didn't, in terms of triglycerides, fasting blood sugar, cholesterol, the different cholesterol fractions and the like.
Which goes along with other research which has come out of the United States, which suggests that people who are a bit fat these days are probably healthier than fat people were 30 years ago for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's a mistake to assume that you can look at somebody and based on their size and shape, tell whether or not they're healthy, tell whether or not they have high blood pressure or cholesterol, or indeed even whether they're physically active or not. Another line of our research over the last 10 or 12 years has been to try to separate out and look individually at fitness and fatness and how these things relate to the development of chronic disease and early mortality.
And this comes from you've been following something like 80,000 people over an extended period of time.
Yes, this comes from a large epidemiological study. We call it the Aerobic Center Longitudinal Study. And we've been following these people for now over 25 years. And again, in different subgroups, in women and in men, in healthy individuals, in those who were sick at baseline, like with type 2 diabetes, when we look at objectively measured fitness, determined by a maximal exercise test on a treadmill, and objectively determined body composition, not self-reported height and weight, or not even just body mass index, but hydrostatic weighing to estimate percent fat, skin folds, waist circumference. We look at all of those things, and the conclusion we come to again and again is that it is low fitness that is a much more important predictor of mortality than is body mass index, fat distribution, overall percent body fat. And I could get up on my soapbox here and rail away because in the obesity literature, time and time again, I guarantee you, somewhere in the world this week in a medical journal, someone published a study on obesity and some health outcome, diabetes, heart attack, whatever, and they will never mention physical activity. Now, I could never get a study published in a reputable journal on physical activity or fitness and some health outcome if I didn't take body weight, body mass index into account. When we do that, it's the fitness, the low fitness that's
by what margin? Important. When you quantify it, what's the difference? Is fitness twice as important as body fat or what?
In our analyses, over and over again, fitness wipes out the hazard associated with obesity. When we look at obese men and women, at least up through class 2 obesity, I don't think there are any fit 500-pound people. But if we look at class 1, class 2 obesity...
What is class 1 and class 2?
A body mass index, which is a ratio of weight to height. 30 to 34.9 is class 1, 35 to 39.9 is class 2. And well up into the class 2 obesity category, we see that those who are fit, as proven by the treadmill test, not because they told us they were physically active, we find their death rate is not elevated at all as compared with normal weight people who are also fit. And indeed, we find that normal weight people who are unfit on the treadmill test are about twice as likely to die during a follow-up of 10 or 12 years when we compare them with the obese people who are fit. You can be fat and fit. Just as, I mean, no one doubts me if I say, well, do you know anyone who's normal weight or even thin and they're sedentary, unhealthy, smoke cigarettes, high blood pressure? I mean, those people exist. Just as there are obese people who are quite healthy, thank you very much. So we have to look at the entire risk profile. And I'm not saying that we should ignore the obesity epidemic. It's clear that it's been going on for 25 years. I think it's a bad sign of unhealthy eating practices and, probably more importantly, decline in energy expenditure. Everyone should eat a healthful diet, try to manage their weight, and get this 30 minutes of activity a day. We should all focus on those behaviors.
Having said all that about fitness and fatness, the tools that are available to doctors, if you come into the doctor, there are certain tools available to doctors which allow them to say, look, what's your blood pressure? What's your cholesterol level? What's your age? And they stick it into a computer program, or even just you can do it on paper, and they say, oh, your chances of a heart attack in the next 10 years are X percent. Very few of these tools add in what you've just been talking about. I don't think there's any, in fact.
Oh, I'd have to say there is one.
And it comes from Professor Steve Blair, does it?
Yes. Again, from this cohort, we look at all the classical risk factors include fitness and plug these into equations. And we published that in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine 2 or 3 years ago. So such risk profiles do exist. But as you're quite right, Norman, most risk profiles do not include even physical activity by self-report, much less measured cardiorespiratory fitness. And I think that's the direction we have to move. The medical profession needs to move toward doing that if they want a better picture of risk stratification.
And when you compare your tool, the most common one used in Australia and the United States is the Framingham tool, which comes from a study which we mentioned many times on the Health Report, which is a group of people, 10,000 or so people who've been followed, their parents and children and now grandchildren, for about 50-odd years. And they don't talk about exercise. And don't even think they talk about obesity in the Framingham tool. When you compare yours in terms of quality of prediction to Framingham, how does it match up?
We are currently working on a paper in which we first take the Framingham risk score and stratify people into different categories of risk based on those calculations.
And essentially, and there's five things in the Framingham risk score which you measure about yourself.
Right. They're the standard risk factors that have come out of cardiovascular disease epidemiology over the last 50 years. They do predict heart attacks, no question about that. But when we further stratify by fitness. And we look, let's say, within the low-risk Framingham category, and we stratify by low, moderate, and high fitness, we see exactly the same kind of gradient that we see in the overall population, which is why I say to physicians often, and I think I mentioned a moment ago, if you're trying to characterize a patient's risk and you use these tools of blood pressure and even body weight or body mass index, you know, the traditional things in Framingham, you're not finished stratifying, but unless you know something about their
fitness. So you could have somebody who's low risk, but by your standard is actually high risk because of their fitness level.
Right. And you can find people in the high Framingham score category. And if they are high fit, their risk is much lower than the Framingham risk score would indicate.
Steve Blair, who's Professor of Exercise Science at the University of South Carolina. And you're listening to the Health Report here on ABC Radio National. Another of the great debates about physical activity is whether increasing the intensity makes any difference. You just heard Steve describe his research, which showed that increased time spent exercising improves your health. But what about the same time spent, but upping the ante and making it more vigorous, jogging, for example, instead of walking? Because for a while, experts were saying it's okay to do your exercise in small bits, gently, like getting up to change the channel on the TV rather than using the zapper, so-called incidental exercise. So what's the story with more strenuous activity? Have we been too soft with the recommendations, and are we too focused on aerobic exercise? Steve Blair again.
Well, the truth is, I don't think we really have adequate data to know for certain. And that's why in this clinical trial with the postmenopausal women, we said we're going to clamp intensity so we know exactly what intensity they're working at. Now, suppose we had had them exercise at 75% of their capacity, would we have seen something different? Well, I don't know. I am trying to get our National Institutes of Health to give me a large grant so that we can investigate this more systematically. And I know there are people who believe passionately that higher intensity exercise provides greater benefit. But the literature on this is extraordinarily sparse, and much of it has a fundamental flaw. And here's the flaw. People have done studies in which they have participants come in, let's say 30 minutes a day, 4 days a week to exercise, and one group exercises at 40% of their capacity and one group exercises at 70%. And then in the end, the 70% group does better, so they say, aha, intensity is what did it. But if they exercise the same number of minutes at different intensities, then the higher intensity group did more work. They spent more calories in the exercise. So we have to, if we want to study intensity, we need to clamp total energy expenditure.
But is that the key to all this? That in fact it's your total energy expenditure that counts, and the benefit from intensity is that you get through, you burn the calories in a shorter space of time, and that that's the metric rather than intensity or not, or time, that it's actually the number of calories you burn per kilogram of body weight?
I think we can be pretty confident that the total caloric expenditure per kilogram body weight per week is a very important metric to determine how much exercise and the benefit. Can you exercise at an intensity so low that that goes away, that no matter you spend 2,000 calories in exercise, if you're working at a very low intensity, will it give you no benefit? That's possible. Again, these things haven't been adequately tested. And of course, remember that if our attention or our concern has to do with weight management, then there's no evidence. I mean, a calorie is a calorie is a calorie, and it's the energy balance that's important. Now, I have never said, and I don't think any reputable person who's worked on these recommendations has ever said, get up and change the channel and that'll make you fit. But we will say, get up and change the channel, you know, buy your vegetables so you have to chop them rather than buy them already chopped up. It does make a difference in caloric expenditure, which again plays into
the energy balance and fitness
and possible weight management, but not activity or not fitness. What we can say about fitness and health benefits is that if you accumulate 30 minutes in 10-minute bouts or more, do at least 10 minutes of at least moderate intensity, and perhaps the best description of that is just brisk walking, not race walking, but just striding along. If you do that for 30 minutes, you're going to get enormous health benefits. Now, to me, a very interesting question is, instead of spending 1,000 calories a week, let us say, at 50% intensity, suppose you could get the same benefit of spending 700 calories a week at a higher intensity. So then you would not only spend much less time, you actually would do less work. It's conceivable that the effects on fitness and health effects might be the same. But we don't know that because that research hasn't been done.
There is some research which I find fascinating, which is that exercise has, that while people like you are looking at people for over 20 years, 30 years and watching them over time and looking at their risk equation, that actually the effect of exercise is immediate on the body and it lasts for, so I've read papers which suggest that it's 3 or 4 days and you reduce your risk today from that exercise bout and it lasts in terms of reduced inflammation in your body, reduced blood pressure and other things that might be going on. And 3 or 4 days later, if you don't do any more exercise, it creeps back up again. So you've got to do a bit more exercise. So that in fact, the good news is here that there's an immediate effect from this. You don't have to invest for 10 years. You just invest for 30 minutes and for the next 4 days you get a benefit. Is that true?
Yes, but there is an immediate effect of exercise on several body systems. And we know, for example, that if you exercise today, it will be reflected in better fasting plasma glucose tomorrow, if you're a person with elevated fasting plasma glucose. We know that there are immediate effects on triglycerides. There are immediate effects on blood pressure. So we know there are these immediate exercise effects. We also know that there are longer range or training or chronic effects because your fitness doesn't improve by your exercise bout today. Your fitness improves by repeated exercise bouts over time. And I think, you know, I believe my own research, that cardiorespiratory fitness is a very strong predictor of morbidity from chronic disease and from mortality. So my friend Bill Haskell at Stanford University wrote a seminal paper 15, 20 years ago in which he talked about the acute effects of exercise, the chronic effects of exercise, and then the augmented effects of exercise, so that today you exercise, you get a little improvement in markers of carbohydrate metabolism. And as you said, that begins to come down then if you don't exercise again. But tomorrow you exercise again, you boost that up again. And then over time, there's an overall trend line heading upward. So 6 months from now, you still get that benefit of today's exercise bout, but you're actually starting from an even better place because of the chronic adaptations that have occurred over the 6 month period. So yes, you get benefits immediately. You get more benefits if you keep it up.
Whilst a lot of the research has been on aerobic exercise, getting your cardiorespiratory fitness up, which means that you burn oxygen more efficiently, there has been a lot of research, and particularly research in Melbourne, suggesting that your muscle strength is extremely important, particularly when it comes to your risk of diabetes. What have you found when you followed these 80,000 people and the prediction or not from your muscle strength?
A good question. Of course, we've known for decades that muscular strength is important for performance, for athletic performance, let us say. And we've known for a couple of decades or more that muscular strength, especially in the lower extremities, is very important for older people in helping prevent falls. But it's only very recently that people have looked at muscular strength and some chronic disease outcomes. And I'm aware of work that's been done here in Australia. We've published 4 or 5 papers on this topic over, this is recent, just the last 3, 4, 5 years. What we found in the epidemiological study is that we see the same inverse gradient across muscular strength categories for all-cause mortality.
Independent of fitness.
As we see for cardiorespiratory fitness.
And it's independent of fitness.
Yeah, we put both terms in the model and they're both significant. We see in older individuals that both cardiorespiratory fitness and muscular fitness are related to protecting you from loss of function. And they're independent. They're both important. In terms of all-cause mortality, we've observed the same finding. We've looked at incident metabolic syndrome. We see the same thing.
That's large waist size, getting towards pre-diabetes and so on.
Right. Yeah, pre-diabetes, risk factor clustering. Here in Australia, you probably define it slightly differently than we do in the
United States. More aggressively, I think.
There are a couple of ways, but it's, you know, people with elevated blood pressure and triglycerides and fasting plasma glucose and a big waist and so forth. Or if I want to really follow my gut instincts here, I think it should be called physical inactivity syndrome, because all of those things can be influenced by physical activity.
So muscle strength predicts these things. And what about coronary heart disease and things like that?
We haven't yet looked at muscular strength and coronary heart disease incidence. We have looked at hypertension incidence. And for the pre-hypertensives, we see an inverse gradient across muscular strength categories for full-blown hypertension.
The stronger your muscles are, right, the less risk you have of developing high blood pressure. And how are you measuring it? Some people measure it just by grip strength. How are you measuring muscle strength?
The data we have comes from one repetition maximum bench press, one repetition maximum leg press, and we have the number of bent leg curl-ups in 1 minute.
And is that at baseline? In other words, whether somebody, when they're 40 and they had high muscle strength, does that effect last through life? Or if they were weak and then became strong, does that make a difference? Have you looked at that?
No. In contrast to our data on cardiorespiratory fitness, where we have many, many thousands of individuals with multiple treadmill tests, I don't really have a large group of people that have had multiple strength tests, so I've not been able to look at change in strength over time. But when we do that for cardiorespiratory fitness, we find that those who improve their fitness substantially reduce their risk.
Given the potency of cardiorespiratory fitness, and given that it overwhelms some of the other risk factors, and it's not popular to say this, is that it even, some people argue in Australia, that it overwhelms smoking as a risk factor. And given that, are we missing something in the risk factors for heart disease? In other words, is there something that fitness is doing to our bodies that we're missing?
I think we are. And if you had asked me 20 years ago, how does exercise and fitness lead to reduced risk of heart attack, I would have started talking about lipid profile and blood pressure and so forth. I no longer do that. I mean, fitness or activity tends to have a beneficial effect on a lot of those classical risk factors, but they're always new and emerging risk factors. For example, we know that low heart rate variability is associated with higher risk of coronary heart disease death.
Just to explain here, we're talking about a complex measure, but it's essentially the more complex your heart rate, the better it is, and the healthier it is, the more variability there is beat to beat. This is not arrhythmia we're talking about, it's just variation beat to beat.
Yeah, tiny variations in milliseconds, and it's far too complicated for me to understand, but I worked with some very bright young people who I think do understand it. We found, for example, in these postmenopausal women, they as a group at baseline had really low heart rate variability, but it improved very rapidly. Why is heart rate variability related to risk of death? Is it simply through, you know, arrhythmic death, sudden cardiac death? Well, that's a possibility. Another possibility is the inflammatory processes. Does physical activity help control systemic inflammation? The answer is still out on that, but it's a possibility. What about the blood clotting mechanisms and removing blood clots? There are things that happen as a result of exercise that may enhance that system. So we're still learning, and people are still searching for various biological pathways. But you know, exercise is one of the things that you can do that affects nearly every bodily system. So there's widespread potential for exercise to be either extremely hazardous or very beneficial, and it seems that it's mostly beneficial. And then after all, that's the way we evolved as active animals.
Steve Blair is Professor of Exercise Science at the University of South Carolina. I'm Norman Swan, and you've been listening to The Health Report. Keep exercising till we meet next time.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.